Blog Talk Radio.
Quiet, please. Welcome to Rex Sykes Movie Beat Conversations with Filmmakers, where we discuss everything film and television. Here on Movie Beat, you'll learn what to do and what not to do when it comes to making movies and TV. And we will talk to everyone behind the scenes and in front of the camera, and they'll provide you with guests and information you're going to want to have, whether you're a filmmaker or a fan. And so now let's move behind the scenes here at Movie Beat. He's back. Gordon Firemark is back, and we're going to continue to talk about funding and raising money and financing your film project. So stay tuned. I'll tell you more about my guest in just a moment. But before that, if you're listening live, the chat room is open, or if you're listening archived, that option's not available to you. But know that all interviews record live, and you can join us from the official website at rexsykes.com. That's my name. I'm your host. It's REXSIKES.com. Right there at Rex Sykes Movie Beat, there's an interviews blog. You go there, you find my guest name. Like for today, it's Gordon Firemark. You read through his biography. Right there, there's a link that says to listen live. You click on it, and voila, you're at the player. If it says to listen and there's no date or time, it means that the show has already been recorded, and you're listening to a recorded show available anytime 24/7. All right, so now that that's clear, whether you're listening live or archived, go ahead and invite somebody to join you in listening to the program. A movie friend, a filmmaker, a contact, an industry connection, somebody sitting across from you there at the coffee shop who's also in the movie business, you know, whoever it might be, just reach out and grab someone, tweet them, Facebook them, email them, and say, hey, you got to check out this show, check out this guest. There's important information being conveyed because Movie Beat is really designed to be a resource for you. And that is why I connect you up with people who are making it happen. People are in the trenches who share their expertise, their know-how, suggestions, tips, advice, what to do, what not to do, how-tos, so that you can advance your career and make your projects, finance your projects, get them from idea to screen faster, smoother, and without as many mistakes. You don't have to reinvent the wheel because you're building on their expertise and their know-how. All right. So we welcome you today. And the only thing that we ask of you, really, in exchange for the information you're getting absolutely free, is to share these interviews. Share them with your friends, your industry connections, by tweeting, during the show, before the show, after the show, when you're listening to the archives, and leaving comments. And you can leave comments right there at the player during the show or after the show. Some browsers may have to close all the way down before you're able to see it. But if you look at the player, there's a chat room. If you're in the chat room, if not, there's a comment window, either under the chat room or under your player. Go ahead and leave a comment before you leave the show today. That helps us out a great deal, helps us increase our presence and visibility on the Internet, and it allows for people to find us, whereas they might not otherwise. All of these interviews are also stored as podcasts at the iTunes store. Please rate and review the shows when you listen to them there. There's over 300 hours of professional filmmakers sharing their expertise with me, with you and me. So let me tell you again about my guest. This is part two. If you haven't heard part one, go back and listen to that sometime after this show. It's important information. You're not going to want to miss it. You're going to want to have it available in your arsenal for your career. Gordon Firemark began his career working behind the scenes in film, television, and theater. Now as an entertainment attorney, that is still what he does. As an attorney whose practice is devoted to the representation of clients in film, television, and theater, he helps producers, directors, writers, actors, and other industry professionals make deals that make sense and that get their productions developed, financed, produced, and distributed. His practice also covers intellectual property, cyberspace, new media, business, and corporate matters for clients in the entertainment industry. As a producer and host of the Entertainment Law Update podcast. He provides a monthly roundup of news and commentary about the field of entertainment law for artists and professionals in the industry. He also teaches producers business. Business people, and lawyers about entertainment legal issues at Loyola Marymount University, Southwestern Law School, and the Theater Producer Academy. Mr. Firemark holds a BA in radio, television, and film from the University of Oregon, and he earned his law degree at Southwestern University School of Law. Before starting his own law firm, he was a partner in Business Affairs Group and worked in the legal business affairs departments at Hanna-Barbera Productions and at MGMUA Worldwide Television Group. He lives just outside of Los Angeles, his wife and two small children, a cat and a mortgage. And he's here to share with us really critical information that you're going to want to have. I'm welcoming Gordon to the show today right now. How are you doing, Gordon?
I'm great, Rex. Good to be here.
Good to have you here. I'm looking forward to our discussion today. Now, as people may recall, we talked about your six methods of funding film, including crowdfunding in part one, and we're going to go back a little bit and recap today. But before we do, let's catch up with you, and let's say that your website is firemark.com. That's F-I-R-E-M-A-R-K.com. Last show, you had a little you had an offering for my listeners at firemark.com/Rex. Is that still available for them today?
That is still available, absolutely.
All right, so you're going to want to check out firemark.com. All right, so how have you been, and what's new?
Well, things are terrific. It's been a busy couple of weeks since we spoke last, and that's encouraging news because this film industry seems to be coming back into, you know, it's the lively thing that it was a few years ago. We've had a rough economy for a few years, and when you work in a field where there's investor financing as a main component of things, when investors are worried about money, the last thing they want to do is invest in highly risky ventures like films. So good news is things seem to be moving and shaking and picking up in that arena.
Well, that is exciting news. That's fantastic news, quite frankly.
Yeah.
Do you have any – I mean, do you think the – I mean – you want to venture a personal opinion? I mean, you think the economy is turning around, or things are getting better, or people are just deciding to go for the movie? I mean, what's happening out there that may be changing this thing around? Any?
I think the California and the movie industry generally seem to lag the economy a little bit, and we've been hearing for about a year now from, you know, government and analysts that the economy is back on a slight upswing, and I'd say it's a fairly gradual upswing. But so I think that's a big part of it. People are sensing that the economy is improving. But also I think people are just tired of waiting. They've been sitting on money for a while, and they're willing to, take some risk with it. I've said for a while that, you know, people think of film investment and theatrical investment and so on as highly risky. But when you look at what's happened in the stock market in the last, 5 years or so, it's hard to distinguish the level of risk that you get from more traditional stocks
It's hard to distinguish the level of risk with mortgages.
Yeah, exactly. Can we do mortgage-backed securities for films? That would be an interesting approach.
given what happened, yeah. No, I mean, that's interesting. It is kind of a sit, you can only sit for so long, and then, wait. And I suppose, people are getting to the, let's just do it, you know?
Yeah. So that impatience is finally turned into some action on the part of investors, and I'm very encouraged by that. So
that is exciting news, and I'm glad that you shared it with us. So you're seeing, you're seeing the activity. I mean, you're seeing people come out and go, okay, now I want to do something.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. And so, that also there's been, I think, a contraction in the number of filmmakers that are out there looking for the funds. So that combines to mean that a somewhat higher percentage of the projects that are, likely to be real are actually getting financed. And that's a good thing. And the other thing is also with the evolution of the web and video on demand and, Netflix streaming and things like that, budgets are coming down in a certain class of films. And, you know, there's always going to be the small and mid and large size budgets, but the micro budgets are actually becoming a more viable opportunity for both filmmakers and investors to get into with distribution channels that are actually available to those kinds of films. So it's possible to make a $200,000 or $300,000 movie, A, because the technology is there to make the film high quality in that budget range, but then also there's a way to get it out into the marketplace and consumers will actually pay to watch it, you know, through these subscription services like Netflix and other streaming services. So, you know, all in all, I think the film industry is it's taken a bit of a turn, and that segment of the industry is very vibrant right now.
I liken it to the pioneering days, or almost to the early film days all over again. I mean, things have mm-hmm. While there's an industry that exists that at one time didn't, and you know, but I mean, it's changed so significantly, and so much of the landscape is as yet unfamiliar, and people haven't figured it out, that it really is an exciting dawning of a new time. And while I say that, I've also been fairly, I guess, critical of the fact that we have so much product out there that is available, that it's driven the business side of it to almost no money at all. You know, because if you could pick up something for a dollar, why pick it up for a million? And I may have a film, and someone else may have a film, and I want to hold out, and they just go next because there's so much product to be had. And while saying that, I do think that there's a change in viewership, and in some ways that you know, I may be too old school with this, but my feeling has been, you know, if you want to get your movie in a theater, it needs to look like a movie you would see in a theater. If you want to get it on YouTube or, you know, on a DVD, you might be lucky no matter how it looks, you know, like the Blair Witch, you know, broke through, or Paranormal Activity, something like that. But in general, and a friend of mine produced a movie, and it cost $10 million, and essentially they shot it in one location. I said, why did it cost so much? And he said, to make it look like something you'd see on the screen. Huh. And yet, all of that is coming down. I mean, you know, what cost $10 million last year may cost $8 this year, and may cost, I mean, in other words, what it takes to look like a movie that you're used to seeing and in the environment that you're used to seeing, is coming down. And make a $200,000. I mean, how exciting is that? That where years ago it might have cost me $20 or $40 million to make the same movie I could maybe make today for $200, $500, or $1 million. And with so little to invest by comparison, hopefully the profits are much larger. I mean, you know.
There's a couple other things interesting in the marketplace right now. That, you know, there are lots of book authors that are writing books and selling them on Amazon for a buck or two a copy. Uh-huh. And I can see that model also possibly working for filmmakers if they're willing to race to the bottom on price a little bit, which, you know, there's a philosophical component to this question. But, you know, if you're willing to put it up there as something that people can, you know, take a dollar or two chance on, then your movie can get seen. And if you get enough of a groundswell of interest, then you can actually make most or all of your money back that way. But maybe making your money back from, you know, screening the film isn't the ultimate goal. You know, nowadays with internet marketing and merchandise and product stuff, that all can be tied together. And again, you can do that yourself at the grassroots level now. Maybe the movie is actually, part of a marketing plan for something more. You get some product into the marketplace and you make your profit maybe on selling T-shirts and sweatshirts and lunchboxes. So,
right. Which is what Disney and all the others have been doing for some time.
Well, sure, on a much
grander
scale.
Now we can
scale,
do it, though. Yeah, mm-hmm. but now the average person can do it. You know, it's, I will say this. The bargain bin mentality, I think, can work. And it used to be, you know, you get your, and it still is, I guess, you get your movie, and let's say you're lucky enough to get a theatrical release, and you have a foreign and domestic, and somehow you're able to track all the monies, and you make or don't make, you know, as however the industry is. Yeah. And then it goes to DVD, and it ends up in a brick-and-mortar store, and it lasts on the shelf for a certain amount of time, and then it goes to or Walmart or whatever, and then it ends up in the bargain bin, you know, where it goes down to, you know, $5 or $1.99, or it's previously owned, and so your amount, your time frame, that window of making, you know, $14.95 or $19.95 on your video is shorter.
Mm-hmm.
But now you could release to Amazon for $1.99 and maybe get millions or hundreds of thousands of people to buy it. Because I walk into a brick and mortar store and I see something for $1.99 or $5. Sometimes I walk out of there with $40 or $50 or $100 worth of video, you know, that I DVD that I hadn't planned to buy, because I just go, whoa, look at this.
Yeah. And when it's coming in as a stream on your computer or on your Apple TV or your, you know, Xbox or something like that, you know, people I think are willing to, you know, sit down in front of that device and take a flyer on something they may not have heard of before, if you've got good one sheet and good descriptive text and that kind of stuff, and maybe a little bit of a buzz, and you can use social media to generate some of that buzz. And so, yeah, we're really seeing, I think, a change in a leveling of the playing field in a way. And, that bargain bin mentality, as you say, is something we have to contend with. And people also, there's a question of perceived value when they buy something for a dollar versus paying 10 or 11 bucks at the movie theater. But I'll tell you, last time I went and spent, you know, $9.50 for a movie ticket and another 10 or 11 bucks on popcorn and soda, and I saw a movie that I thought was a piece of junk, you know, I've started to really question the value proposition of paying for a ticket and going to the theater.
Well, I got to stop you right there. You haven't been to the movie in 10 years. I'm kidding. With those prices.
I beg your pardon?
You haven't been to the movies in 10 years with those prices, $9.50 for a ticket.
Well, you know, I live
in the
far suburbs.
No, I know what you're saying. I'm kidding. It is exciting. It really, truly is exciting. It is, for instance, I have one movie that I bought on my iPhone. It was a friend of mine's, and I bought his movie on the iPhone, and I really haven't bought any others that way, because I go, I want to have the DVD. I want to have something in my hand that I can put in the machine.
Yeah.
But, you know, there are people growing up who putting something in a machine is secondary to having it on their computer.
Yeah.
And the world changing in that way.
And that's a generational thing, I think. Those of us who are used to having something physical to hold and pass on, you know, are going the way of the dodo eventually. So.
Oh, yeah. You know, I'm surprised that the credit card companies don't give credit cards to, like, 10-year-olds. I mean, my 13-year-old daughter, almost every time I see her on the computer, I go, what are you doing? She goes, YouTube. You know, she's watching people that she likes who are now big commercial successes, you know, but things that she likes on YouTube. And now YouTube is offering, you know, full movies and things like that. And if, you know, if my daughter had a credit card instead of my credit card, she wouldn't have any money left, I'm sure. She would be buying it.
Neither would you.
Right? Yeah, no, I know it's the way it is. But, you know, but no, I mean, yeah, I mean, there's a restriction of what she could buy. But, I mean, people can download these things to Nooks and to iPads and to iPhone. I mean, it is truly, truly interesting. Now, the one thing I will say, and I know I'm going to assume that you're in agreement with this, is that for the young filmmaker or any filmmaker, if I make a movie tomorrow and I got great crowdsourcing and I've made my movie and I've got good social media and I've got a great following and I have the top of the line marketing dollar that I can spend and I create a great one sheet, a great art, everything else, and I sell this film, I'd better deliver a good movie to these people if I want to make my reputation as a filmmaker and have them come buy my next $1.99 film. Don't you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think you get, you know, one or maybe two bites at the apple, and if you're not delivering the goods, then people are going to stop giving you their dollar or two, even as little as a dollar or two. So, yeah, you're right.
So the bottom line is, if you're going to do it, you get your ducks in a row, and that's why we're talking about financing today, why people go to attorneys, you know, because they want to make sure they do everything properly and right. And if you're doing a movie, you know, I always try and tell people, don't rush until you got the best movie there, you know. And some people, just after they spent 5 years shooting and editing and doing everything, they just go, I want to be done with it. And I'm like, if there's a good movie in it, hold on to it till it's the best movie you possibly have, then market it wisely and get it out there, because it's easier to finish something than it is to start something.
Mm-hmm.
And
it might be, yeah, it's important.
I mean, it's more exciting to start something.
Yeah, it is. But, you know, it's really important to think of a film project as a small business, in a sense.
Right.
You are starting a business the day that you, you know, organize the company and you know, your script is sort of your business plan, in a sense. You really need a real business plan as well, but the script is the description of what the product is. And, you know, starting any new business is a long-term proposition. It isn't we build the product and we sell it and we make our fortune and then, you know, by the time next Christmas comes around, we're on to something else. You have to think of it as a long-term business, and you need to have some runway for the project to get off the ground. Now, that said, it's shorter than many businesses, you know, because there is the life cycle of a film. Once it comes out, it starts to go stale pretty quickly, unless it becomes a cult classic or something like that. So, but the important thing is to think of it as a business, and that brings us right into our discussion of how you go about financing a film.
All right, so. Awesome.
Should we recap the first five of the six ways to finance a feature film that we talked about last time, and then we'll jump into the investor financing in a little more depth. So,
absolutely.
Okay, so the first one was the Rich Uncle Guido. This is basically family money or your personal money that you're devoting to the film with really no strings attached. It's a gift, and or money you already had in the bank, and you're spending it on making a movie. You know, you're your own investor, essentially, and you're taking the chance that you're going to lose that entire amount, and nobody's going to, you know, shake their heads and wag their fingers at you if that's what happens, except, of course, yourself and your financial people. The second one is the single active investor. This is where you basically bring on, you know, one or maybe two people who are going to be, you know, deeply involved in the operation of this business and helping you with the making of the film. They may not be, you know, they may not be on set with you, but they are watching the money. They're involved in all the decision making and so on. That active investor essentially is your partner or a joint venturer in the deal, and that can sometimes be a company, and that's what we call a co-production structure. The next two are the studio setup and the studio production finance and distribution PFD deal, and those two models are, you know, the holy grail here is basically get it set up in a movie and get them to let you make your movie your way. That's the PFD deal. The setup is a little more of just a sale of the property and you collect a fee and go about your business while they make your movie. And then number five was the negative pickup deal. This is the model where you pre-sell the distribution, you know, sometimes in one lump thing, but more often than not, territory by territory, till you've got enough territories promising to pay you the money you'll need to make the movie. And then you take all those contracts, those promises, to a bank, and you borrow the money to make the movie against those promises. Those promises essentially becoming the collateral for the deal. And this is a very complicated technical approach to financing films. It was very popular in the 80s and 90s. It has lost popularity a little bit over the last decade or so because of the shrinking in the available dollars for advances from distributors. Distributors are taking less risk, not willing to spend as much on the front end to buy the rights to distribute a film. And so it's harder to raise that money from selling off those territories. Certainly an important component of any film project is to know that you're going to be able to distribute it in various territories. So those commitments are still valuable, but they may not be bankable in that situation. So that's the negative pickup deal. And that brings us right to investor financing. And last time we talked a little bit about this, particularly in the context of crowdfunding, but we can get into that in some real depth now.
Awesome.
Let me take a sip of water.
Surely.
Okay. So, the investor financing is the go out and find a bunch of rich people to put their money into your movie, and they sit back and wait for profit while you go make your movie and try to get it distributed and all of that. The big advantages for investor financing is that the filmmaker generally gets to make his movie his way, his or her movie his or her way. the investors aren't going to be meddling in the day-to-day operations. Their creative involvement is they read the script or the synopsis and they decide, yes, I'm going to invest or no, I'm not. And they don't get to say, you know, I don't like your choice of casting, or I don't like the selection of the director or something like that. That is left to the producer who, once the money is accumulated, they go off and make their movie. It has great upside potential. You know, the typical model is after the investors have recouped some of their all of their invested money, the profits from the film are divided usually 50-50 between the producer and the investors. So the upside is nice for the producers, and also not bad for the investors, frankly. To get all your money back and then half of the profit of the film is a pretty attractive approach, and that's why it works. Another big advantage is that the investor is limited in liability. Because they're not involved in the operation of the business on that day-to-day, hands-on level, they're also able to enjoy protection from lawsuits and losses. And if the film goes over budget, nobody's coming to them looking to make up the difference and those kinds of things. So that's the traditional investor model. But it does have some disadvantages as well. You know, not the least of which is the cost and complexity of making these deals happen. The legal cost is significant. The time and energy cost in terms of making it right and doing it correctly adds up to quite a lot as well. And then, of course, you do actually have to find people willing to invest in your movie. So so that's a tough component as well. And that really comes down to packaging the project as well as you can, basically as though you're going to sell it to the distributors or to the studios or anything. You need to have a package that is compelling and that tells the business folks that, you know, there is actually a customer base, an audience base for this kind of project. And then, you know, the biggest disadvantage, as I sort of hinted, is the regulatory component of things. Let's talk about securities law and why this is such a complex and costly endeavor. Okay. So let's start off with what's a security. About 65 years ago, the Securities Exchange Commission, so this is in the 40s, I guess, the SEC sued an investment advisor business that was selling securities over whether or not the transactions it was doing were subject to Securities Exchange Commission regulation. And the test that came out of that case helps us decide whether or not we are looking at a securities transaction or something else. So that in order to decide whether something is a security, we look at three components. Is the investor making an investment with an expectation of a profit and investing in some kind of a common enterprise with an expectation of profit, and it depends on the efforts of others? So that's the passive component. So if it's passive, you're looking to get a profit, and it's, you know, not just your money, but people are pooling the money, that's going to look like a securities transaction, whether it's a shares of stock or membership interests in a limited liability company or limited partnership shares as well. This is going to be a security. And the basic rule when you are selling securities is it has to be registered with the Securities Exchange Commission. And that registration process, basically the idea of an IPO or a public offering of some sort, is a complex, time-consuming, like a year time-consuming, and very costly process to comply with all of the regulations and rules for registering a securities offering. Now, when you're raising, you know, less than $5 or $10 million, that time cost, opportunity cost, and the real dollar cost of doing all that compliance and registering almost outweighs the value of registering the transaction in the first place. So the Securities Exchange Commission and Congress now have come up with some exemptions from this registration requirement that basically say if you're going to a limited number of people that you already know, you're not making a public offering to sell these shares, then we're going to be exempt from the registration requirement if you comply with a certain set of rules. These rules are what are usually referred to as Regulation D, Rules 504, 505, and/or 506. These are sort of different classes of these exemptions. I'm not going to get into the nitty-gritty of all of what those all say, but what they have in common is restrictions on who you can approach, how you can approach them, how much money you can raise, and what you have to tell them and disclose to them in making the offer. So, you know, who you can approach. There are slight differences from one rule to the next, but basically you can always approach people that are called accredited investors. These are people with a high net worth of personal net worth of over $1 million, excluding their primary residence, and or with a high level of sophistication in making financial decisions in the financial markets and so on. So sophisticated investors essentially are what we call accredited investors. And you can approach an unlimited number of those people under these rules. The trick is, if you're raising less than $5 million, you can also go to, you know, mom and pop, the non-accredited investors. But you're limited with the number of those people you can go to. It has historically been 35 non-accredited investors that you can approach.
But and, they can be mixed.
Beg your pardon?
I said, but they can be mixed.
It can be a mix. You can have up to 35 non-accredited and an unlimited number of accredited investors in your offering. Now, the trouble is that it's 35 that you may approach. So if you get 34 nodes, you're counting on one person to invest, you know, an awful lot percentage of the investment. So you need to be careful about who you approach with the unaccredited investor side of things. Now, this is one of the things that is changing as we speak in the wake of the passage of the Jobs Act, which included some crowdfunding and lifting of the restriction on the general solicitation language. But we're waiting for the government to issue its regulations now that Congress has acted, and I think we've got another few months before we will see, you know, the resulting changes to the rules. And it may be that the general solicitation, and in fact it is, that the general solicitation really needs to be targeted at the accredited investor types. In the crowdfunding space, though, the good news is we're going to be able to raise up to $1 million from non-accredited, you know, just your basic mom-and-pop folks that are doing investment through crowdfunding, who can invest up to a percentage of their income. I don't remember those figures off the top of my head. I think it's 10% of their income, or $10,000 in a given year. So that's another component of this. So that may be lifting that 35 offeree restriction as well.
So let me have you finish your thought, and then I have a question.
No, but let's go ahead. I think I finished that thought.
Oh, well, just that I guess my statement is again, you know, your advice to think of this as a small business and to keep records of all of these things so you don't inadvertently get 37
right.
people or, you know, something. I mean, the need to be precise when you're working in this.
Yeah, and we're going to get to the discussion of what the offering really is and the mechanics of how to go about approaching people a little bit, and again, subject to the fact that all of this is likely to change a little bit in the next year or so as the regulations come out that implement the Jobs Act. But
so, do you expect that the crowdfunding platforms that currently exist will change in some way? I mean, right now it's donations, so they'll have, like, you can either have a donated movie where people continue the way it has been, and or you can choose to go an investment route? Or does it look like the Jobs Act will do away with the form of crowdfunding we know now?
Well, that's the real worry, that the crowdfunding folks that have set up their businesses on this donation model are expressing, is you know, did we just essentially take the wind out of the sails of this donation model because now investors might be able to get a return on investment? And there's a lot of discussion and hemming and hawing over whether that's really what's going to happen. And I personally don't think that the donation model is going to go away. I think that that's going to still be useful for a lot of small businesses that are just trying to get off the ground and just need a little early push to, you know, to get some capital so they can do what they need to do. And again, it's that sort of, you called it a bargain bin mentality, but if I can throw 10 or 15 bucks at someone and 1,000 of us do that, and now they've got 15 grand to get started, you know, I'm not worried about making a return on my 15 bucks, but if I'm writing a check for $5,000 or $10,000,
right,
now I'm looking, I want to make a return. So it's going to be a question of scope. I don't know that the Kickstarters and the Indiegogos and those kinds of folks are going to themselves get into this investment crowdfunding model, or whether they're going to spin off separate businesses to do that. I think it probably makes sense to have separate entities do that, but they may find ways to aggregate the opportunities and give the backers a choice. Are you looking for investor projects, or are you looking for donation style projects? Or maybe what you do is you let them, you know, find the project that seem most attractive, and this donation versus investment is one of the components of that. But I think it was Kickstarter said that they're not really expecting to get into the investment business under the Kickstarter brand, so they'll probably spin off another brand to do that.
I see. Okay, fair enough. Yeah.
Yeah. So let's get back to the requirements under these exemptions from the registration. And when I say it's an exempt from registration, it's not exempt from any government oversight at all. The government is still interested, but they're not going to go through the entire vetting process that they would with a registered, you know, public offering of securities. What you have to do is, after you receive some investor money, you have to file a form with the government. It's a fairly complex form. It takes several hours to complete, not unlike a tax return in its level of complexity. And you do that at the federal level, but also in each state where an investor resides. So you have to comply with each state's securities registration rules as well. And most of the states also have exemptions that apply here. That's another thing that's been tweaked a little bit by the Jobs Act, is that the federal law will preempt the state law in many instances. That doesn't mean you don't have to file some documents, but if you do it right under the feds, you're going to be in compliance under the state rules as well. So we've got the limited number of investors, the limited kinds of investors that you can approach, and how you approach them, in terms of the general solicitation versus going directly to people you have a connection or a relationship with. That the latter is the historic approach. You've had to have a pre-existing relationship with the people you approach for money, and that was a tricky thing when you're looking for a lot of money, because that means you need to know a lot of rich people. And if you know a lot of rich people, you're probably one of them, and you know, maybe it's less of a concern, but it's been a little bit of a catch-22. Regardless of who you're approaching and how you're approaching them, the important thing is this exemption doesn't take out the rules about fraud. You still have to comply with the anti-fraud rules under the Securities Exchange Act that say, basically, you have to disclose all of the material factors that might influence an investor's decision-making process in whether or not to invest in a particular project. So that means a lengthy discussion of the risk factors, a lengthy discussion of the who, the what, the where, the when, the how, the why, how you intend to make your money back. All of that stuff has to be disclosed in order for the investor to make an informed, educated decision about whether to invest. And so what we do then is prepare a document that's usually called a private placement memorandum, private placement referencing the fact that this is not a public offering, it's a private offering to people we already have that connection with. The private placement memorandum is essentially the core financing document in these deals. And it lays out, like I said, all of the risk factors, all of the financial terms of what the deal looks like for the investors. It lays out the business plan for the film, you know, a synopsis of the project, the budget, the you know, the explanation of what the anticipated distribution landscape is going to look like, what the revenues might be. And you have to be very careful when you're making projections about revenues that they are, you know, smart, real projections based on some valid assumptions. And this is one of the areas that trips up filmmakers a lot, is they think that, well, because Blair Witch Project did this well, and this film is also a Verite-style thing shot in, you know, in the woods somewhere, it's going to make the same kind of money. Well, that's not a valid assumption. And that's one of the areas where filmmakers need to be very cautious. In fact, I counsel them, if you don't have good, solid financial assumptions in place, it's better to say, you know, not to have projections at all, and just to indicate the risk that it's possible we won't find any distribution at all. It's possible we will be underrepresented in the distribution market, and it's possible that we'll have some success, and leave it at that. It makes it a little harder to sell to an investor when you don't have those projections, but it can be a very costly, very risky game to make projections in the first place. That's not to say you shouldn't include a table of some box office comparables as well. I guess nowadays it's not box office as much as DVD comparables, you know, sales comps.
Right, right.
But, you know, it's one thing to say, well, Blair Witch made a lot of money, and here's the numbers it did. It's another to say, our film is just like Blair Witch, so we're expecting the same thing. Let that
assumption there, or that. Is there an up or downside to saying, you know, okay, here's my movie, Blair Witch did this, or Paranormal Calamity did that, or Activity did this, and then saying, and here are other films that didn't do as well. I mean, but here's a reasonable expectation, you know, kind of like here's the sky's the limit, and here's the bottom line low end, or do you go? Are you ever putting anything in that fails, or is it like, well, this?
No, that's a real good idea, and that's another thing that filmmakers often neglect is to inject that dose of reality in when they're doing that box office comparables table or that sales comps table. Is it makes sense to show that there is, you know, there is a failure rate as well, or a downside rate as well. It's not fair to the investor to say, well, here are 10 films that did fantastic at the box office, without also saying, and here are at least 10, probably more like 90, that didn't
right.
do as well. And well, maybe enough to say, of course, these are not representative of the entire film landscape. Maybe you know, harping on it too much is not a good idea. But
I don't mean to control. Well, I was just going to say it goes back to a question I believe I asked you in part one of this discussion that we had, and that is the investors are buying the person more than they're buying the package, whether the person is trustworthy. If they, I'm not saying the package is an important. What I'm saying is that the person, if they're trustworthy, if they're savvy, I mean, savvy business investors can tell, I mean, usually pretty much can tell whether a package is full of crap or not, can't they? I mean, they just look at it and go, this is bogus. I mean, the not-so-savvy investor may have more trouble, but I would think if you're trying to reach people who invest and have the likelihood of investing, the clearer you are, the more honest you are, the more you can present the upside and the downside, the more trustworthy you come off, you know.
Right.
So, you know, because if I just try to snow you with a Blair Witch Project, I think I've got a greater potential of losing you than if I say, hey, you know what? I mean, a lot of people try this, but not everybody succeeds too. So,
yeah. Right. Yeah. And so it's a dangerous thing to get into, putting these documents together and omitting the stuff that doesn't reflect well. It's worth being really candid about both the upside and the downside. Yeah.
And hence, again, now, can I do a PPM? Can I do the – or I mean, I'm going to say – Rex is going to say, I think you need an attorney to do it.
Well, the lawyer's going to say that too.
Well, I know, and I figure you're an attorney. You're going to say the same thing. But, I mean, but the point really – I mean, when it comes down to it, unless you really are well-versed in doing this, and even then it might be worthwhile having someone check it over, you know, you should make sure that your I's are dotted and your T's are crossed before you run out there and try and –
Just like it's a bad idea to compare your film's financial projections on to another film that's already been done. It's a really bad idea to base your financial structure, your financing documents, on those that have been used. You know, just because it worked for another film in the past doesn't necessarily mean that the rules haven't changed, the goalposts haven't moved, which we've just seen Congress did a bit of that, you know, this month. But also, you know, your film isn't, unless it's an exact cookie cutter copy of the other in terms of every component, it needs to be custom tailored, and we need to think not just about what the document says, but also what it doesn't say, and understand the ramifications of including things, leaving things out, spinning things a certain way. And that really is something that those of us with this kind of training are going to be better at advising. I'm not saying that filmmakers can't do it themselves. I'm saying that you wouldn't perform surgery on yourself, and I think that you probably shouldn't do your own legal work, because there's a personal investment component of things that maybe a neutral third eye, a third set of eyes on a situation can really bring to the table. The biggest mistake I see filmmakers do in terms of managing their cost and putting these things together is trying to draft their own PPM and then bringing it in to me to polish and tweak. In most of those instances, it actually costs them more than if they'd had me do it myself from the outset, because looking from documents and forms that I'm very familiar with, and I know that I can trust, and I know where to find things, and I don't spend hours and hours just poring over this document that was written maybe once five generations ago by a lawyer, but now it's been rewritten by filmmakers who are great at telling stories, not so great at warning about risks and rewards and things like that. So go ahead.
I'm just gonna say that's the greatest point that I just want to piggyback on it. That filmmakers are great at telling stories. I mean, that may not be useful when they're trying to do other things. You know, I mean, it's like they need to. You know, it's just like you have a grip and you've got a DP and you got a sound person and you got an editor and you got a craft service and you got all these different people with different expertise. You need that same expertise and that same mentality when you're producing your film in the development stages of your film, you know, and that is to hire the best and the wisest that you can afford to make certain that everything is going as it should be and that you don't get into trouble.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Another component of this is that your private placement memorandum is not a sales document. You need to sell the investor on investing in, like we said last time, you, the person, the project itself, and they have to like the material, and maybe the package, that is the talent, the attachments and so on, as part of the project. But also what you're selling them is the idea of being a part of this project. In these smaller films with investor financing, so much of the time the investor's coming in for reasons other than purely the potential financial gain, but because they want to be a part of something. Maybe that's an artistic decision on their part, or maybe it's just a gut reaction to something, or maybe it's vanity. Maybe they want to see their name in the credits. You know, there's lots of reasons that people make decisions, and so helping to target that means maybe even bringing in another party. You know, like I said, the filmmaker's great at telling the story, the lawyers are great at telling the risks and the warnings and keeping you out of trouble. And someone needs to be maybe involved in the sales process who's good at that component of things. That is, helping you craft the message, the sales message to the investors. That person's also going to be really valuable in crafting the message to the distributors later on, and ultimately to the customers. And that would be someone who's good at sales and copywriting and marketing stuff. So, I think a film ought to have multiple producers so that there's the producer who's focused on the artistic integrity of the piece, and there's the producer who's focused on the business integrity of the piece, and there's the producer or someone on the production team who's responsible for, let's make sure we can sell it.
To whoever. You know, I really... No, I like that because I think the producer role is so severely misunderstood by most people. Either they think all producers should raise money, and if they don't raise money, then they're not a producer, or all producers should be creative, and they should, you know, I mean, and there are different forms of producers, and what you just said about having multiple producers on a project, again, very insightful because it's really hard for one person to do it all and be an expert in everything.
Yeah, you know. Again, back to that, think of it as a business model. You know, you don't start a company, well, some people do start companies where they are the only person wearing all of the hats. And, you know, as often as not, when they want to grow and succeed, that's when they bring in a salesman and a marketing person and a financial person and maybe legal counsel and so on. So, you know, you really do have to build a team. And the producing team, it's not to say that they all wouldn't have their hands in the other components, but...
Right.
You know, someone needs to drive the truck on each of these different aspects of things. And, so I think that, you know, building a good team is an important component. And some producers are really good at wearing those multiple hats. But often as not, we need to find ways to play to our strengths and have other people play to our weaknesses so that we round out the team and move the ball down the field, I guess is the metaphor.
Wow. That is excellent. I'm gonna stop you just for a second. So I got to take a break here, and then we'll come right back and continue. It's fascinating, absolutely fascinating. Part two with Gordon Firemark on discussing funding and financing your feature films. You're listening to RexSykes.com. It's the official web address of Rex Sykes Movie Beat. My upcoming guests will be Sam Christensen on Monday the 7th, Clint Howard, actor, on Tuesday the 8th, and I should say Sam is an acting mentor and a branding guru and an image consultant, former casting director. He knows his stuff. Clint Howard, you've known him since Gentle Ben and in all sorts of movies for the past 50 years. Nicholas Tabarrok is a prolific producer. He'll be joining us on Wednesday the 9th. Kim Swanson is a casting director. She'll be joining us on the 10th, and Peter Marshall on the 11th. And then we have other guests coming up, including Peter Foley, I want to mention him, and Jason Brubaker, who's filmmaking stuff. He's got a new book out as well, and many other people to come. I do want to give a quick shout-out to Pete Schwabe. He's a director. He's a friend of Rex Sykes Movie Beat and of mine personally. He directed a movie called The Godfather of Green Bay. Now, tonight on Wisconsin Public Television, channels 21.2 and 38.2 out of Madison, Wisconsin, and Green Bay, respectively, and the Wisconsin Channel, which is a streaming channel. It streams like as long as they program. He's going to be on a show called The Director's Cut at 9 p.m. Central Time, and his movie, Godfather of Green Bay, will air immediately afterwards at 9:30 p.m. Central Time. I believe tonight and tomorrow you have to check local listings, and let me give you the web address for the streaming channel, and I'll tell you just a second about it. It's WPT, that's walkpointtalk.org/Wisconsin Channel. That's WPT.org/Wisconsin Channel. And when you get there, there's a little Wisconsin sign that says WIS. You got to go down and read where it says pop-up player. And it says, can't see the video, this link. Well, you click on that, and it'll bring up the live streaming window. So you can watch Godfather of Green Bay if you haven't seen it. It's a fun movie. It's a cute movie. It stars Lauren Holly and Tony Goldwyn and Pete and others. And it's a fun movie. And Pete will be talking about it at 9 p.m. Central Time on the Wisconsin Channel this evening and tomorrow evening. So tune in. And we're back now with Mr. Gordon Firemark, entertainment attorney, discussing funding and financing your feature films. And a fascinating discussion it is. His website is firemark.com. It is FIREMARK.com. And as well, he has an offering. If you're listening to this show, you can contact him and go to firemark.com/Rex and check out what he has there available for you, because he's got some great stuff and you're going to want to look at it. All right, Gordon, we're back.
Okay. And where were we? We were sort of wrapping up the discussion on what goes into the offering documents for a film. And you know, one thing I sort of neglected to say is which entity structure most films tend to use. And historically, it was the limited partnership structure. And I don't want to get into the nitty-gritty of why it was a limited partnership. And what we would have would be the producer would form a corporation that would act as the manager of the limited partner structure, and that way everybody had the limited liability protection from some of the risk. And then in the 90s, we saw the evolution of the limited liability company, the LLC, and that has become pretty much the preferred model for financing independent films these days. But I just wanted to get that out there. And so what you're selling when you're selling these securities is a membership interest in that company. Sorry about the background noise, by the way. It's Friday morning, and my kids don't go to school on Fridays, so they're...
Oh, cool. No worries.
Yeah. And I'm doing this from home today, so...
Awesome.
So, anyway. So, I guess our next thing we ought to talk about is I mentioned that the investor financing, the doing the PPM, getting the companies up and running and ready for the financing to happen, is a tremendously costly endeavor. I would say the neighborhood is starting just around $10,000 in legal fees for an investor financing package. And so one of the things that we need to mention is how you might be able to go about raising that money too, the get started money.
Right.
And that's one of the areas where crowdfunding has been pretty effective for filmmakers. I've seen Indiegogo and Kickstarter used to raise what we call front money, and or seed money is the other term, and that has worked nicely. But the other thing you can do is actually bring in an investor early on who will make their contribution and take the elevated risk of loss. That if you don't even raise the rest of the money for the project, they're going to lose what they've invested. And what you do with them is you give them a little quid pro quo, a little something in exchange for that extra risk that they're taking, which comes out of that producer's side of the pie. So essentially what's happening is front money investors coming in with their, let's call it $50,000 that's going to cover your option on the script, and paying the lawyers and maybe hiring a casting director and helping putting the packaging together and so on. And they get what $50,000 would buy in investment interest in the company when it's formed. But they also get maybe half again as much coming from the producer's side of the profit pie. Sometimes less than half as much, but so they've got $50,000 worth of investment and maybe $25,000 worth of what the producer would see. And
this is a long term. I mean, this is for the life of the project,
No, it tends to be life of the project. Another approach is sometimes that money is actually treated as a loan and paid back with interest. However long it takes to raise the financing, and then there's some interest calculation, so they might get, $55,000 worth of investment in the project for their $50,000, some kind of an enhanced investment model. But the point is that this is early money before the offering is done, and so, you do this with one or two people, and you raise that front money. And so I didn't want to frighten off potential filmmakers that are looking at this model without telling them that there are ways to use other people's money even for the early legal expenses and things like that.
Oh, right, right.
Yeah. So
you often hear the term, first in, last out, and this kind of thing. Is there any form, and this is before you've even got your production money, this is to do the legal stuff, but is there any way to kind of help these people who would be first in, whether it's the development money, the seed money, or the first investors into the project to be comfortable being the first rather than last? I mean, otherwise it seems like everybody just waits until everyone else jumps in beforehand. Advantages?
Yeah, that's the reason for giving them that slice from the producer's side of the equation. Is that they then are able to get a little something extra, as I said. But that is the real danger, is that first money last out, if ever, is the way I would characterize the the discussion. You know, and credit is another thing that you can give in that area to ensure that that investor, you know, is getting something valuable that they might appreciate. You know, maybe it's an executive producer credit. Maybe it's, you know, just a special thanks or something like that. It sort of depends on everything else involved. But certainly that investor who comes in with front money is entitled to something more. And, you know, that's just going to be a question of can you persuade this person to do it? Usually that's going to be one of your closest connections who you go to for that front money. And it might not be a person so much as a company that's willing to put up a little money to get the ball rolling so they can come in and do a co-production with you once you're up and going. And, you know, there's all kinds of ways to formulate the payback model on that. But, you know, all of the investors get their money back first. So they're made whole, that is, they get to zero before the producer ever sees a penny from the film. It's not exactly first money, first out. It's still, you know, first in, last out. But, you know, there is a sort of preferred rate of return. Whereas if you go in and you invest in, you know, shares of IBM, you don't get your money back, you know, first. You get dividends when the company pays dividends, period. And, yeah, so it's a little bit of a different model there. So one thing I want to mention is, you know, we talked about these six ways of financing a film. And I think I said early on in the discussion that, you know, no one of these ways is the only way you can use. You know, if you can get some investor financing or a rich uncle financing or something like that, and that gets you far enough along the line to sell it to a studio, well, that puts you in a position to pay back your investors or to get your own money out. And now you've got it set up at a studio. Similarly, you can mix and match the negative pickup model with the investor financing model, and that's great because, again, if you've got some pre-sold territories, doesn't that make it more attractive to investors who realize that their money is going to essentially go farther in making this movie because you've got the pre-sale? Or they're going to be able to get their money out that much faster because that pre-sale is already in place. And so they know that, okay, you're making this million-dollar movie. You've got $300,000 in pre-sales. That means the movie, you only need to find another $700,000 before they're going to start seeing their returns. You know, it's just a little easier that way. Similarly, the active investor co-production, it becomes a much more attractive project when you are going to those co-producer prospects, when you already have some investor financing in place or where you already have that pre-sale in place. You can understand why, you know, the co-producer would be more excited about getting involved at that point. So it's a hybrid model. You don't have to use just one or just the other. And I guess the crowdfunding, like I said, you can use that for front money. You can also use it for the P&A on the back end. So you've made your film, and now you realize, okay, maybe you need some finishing money so you can get pay for the music soundtrack. So you might go to crowdfunding to raise some money so you can get, buy the rights to some music that you want to use. Or you're going to do a theatrical release on a what we call a four-wall deal, where the producer essentially rents the theaters and screens the movie a few times. And there's a lot of reasons that filmmakers do that. One is to be eligible for various awards, including the Academy Awards. Another is if you've had a theatrical release in the U.S., your film can be more attractive to foreign distributors, probably just because there's a little more buzz. You know, if they can show clippings from the newspapers and advertising that this film is out and it's playing on however many screens and so on. So there can be reasons that the filmmakers themselves want to go out and raise the money to pay for prints and advertising the film in a theatrical release. And so you could use the crowdfunding model for that to a certain extent. And I think that's one of the places we're going to see the new crowdfunding models working really well, because you can raise $1 million and, you know, that buys you a few screens for a few days and some advertising to support it. And that can be really helps make it a more attractive project for distribution in the foreign markets. So
That is fascinating. I'm surprised by how many people raise money to produce a film, but they don't think about post, and they don't think about the, you know, marketing of the film afterwards. Which to me, I would think that if I were investing in something, I'd want to know, okay, what does it cost to make it, but what does it actually cost to get it to an audience? I mean, in other words, where I'm going to start seeing my money come back is where. So, I as a producer would want to fund the entire thing as best as possible rather than funding part of it and then falling into that whole gap area.
Yeah, and in fact, that's a big issue in when, remember I mentioned the anti-fraud rules is, you know, if you are going out to investors with a budget for a film that doesn't include a budget to post the film, what you're basically saying to your investors is, I'm going to invest a whole bunch in raw materials and I'm going to build the shell of a house, but I'm not going to ever close it off to the elements, or I'm not going to put windows and doors in it, you know. So you really need to finance the budget of a film needs to include post-production, or else you're not really making a movie. You're making half a movie. And investors, I think that's a very material fact that investors need to understand, is that once this film is in the can and you've got an exposed negative, well, nowadays everything's video, you know, electronic,
right,
but
right.
Once you've got that exposed negative, you're only halfway there, maybe less than halfway. You know, 6 weeks in production and 6 months in post-production isn't at all an unusual model. So I think that's a really important point you make. You're not just financing the principal photography. You've got to finance the whole shebang.
Yeah, so. I mean, it never fails to surprise me, and I guess it doesn't shock me, but it surprises me that someone will say, "Yeah, I got my movie, and now I don't have any money to get into festivals."
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, well, what did you expect? I mean,
yeah, well, that's another way that the crowdfunding can be useful is, you know, you want to enter a few festivals
right.
and you need to travel to be there and markets too, you know, maybe you want to go to Cannes so you can help try to sell your movie. You know, that costs a fair bit of money to go and be there for the week.
Right.
So you can use crowdfunding that way as well. But yeah, I think having a marketing budget in your budget is an important thing too. I think that's always the first one to go when you realize, oh, okay, well, that's going to push us over the top for SAG's, you know, low budget model or something like that. And so there are approaches to doing that sort of keep you in a safe harbor, and that's something again that having a lawyer who understands the stuff and can give you some good advice on these things can help a lot. And so I guess my message there is, get your lawyer involved earlier rather than later, and think of it as part of a team building.
Absolutely, I think that's very sage advice. Let me ask you, Gordon. Actually, a number of questions, but I'm not sure which one to ask first. I had a follow-up to something you just said, and I kind of spaced out while I was thinking the other way. Let me ask you the one of the other ones first. And that is, what's the viability today? I mean, we hear a lot of different things about, you know, the days of negative pickup are gone, they're over, you know, don't count on it, pre-sales, you know, territory. From your experience, I mean, can you shed some light on where we are in this and what the likelihood of someone getting some of these other forms of financing might be?
Well, you know, I mean, I think I want to make a distinction between the negative pickup model and just basically pre-selling a film, because I think still happening is pre-sales. It's harder, and there's not as much advance money coming in on the pre-sales. But again, having certain territories or lots of territories sold off means that the investors can take greater faith in the film performing than if they're just investing in, we're going to go make a movie and then try to sell it. You know, it's always better to make a product that you know there's a buyer for than to make a product and hope there's a buyer. So those distribution deals essentially reflect the fact that there is a buyer. Whether those distributors can get people to come and pay to see it in the theater or buy the DVDs is, you know, it's not just their problem, but it's on them to make that happen. So you want distributors you can trust. But I guess my point is, having pre-sales is still a worthwhile thing, and getting a sales agent distributor's rep involved in the process early is another part of your team. You know, don't wait until the film is in the can, I guess is what I'm saying. The negative pickup
deal. Good point. Right.
I haven't seen one in 10 years.
In what? A negative pickup?
I haven't seen a negative pickup deal, a traditional negative pickup deal
in
10 years.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
And that, by that I mean where the deal is in place and you go to the bank and borrow the money.
Right.
That said, you know, I've seen individual credit lines come forward and essentially, you know, be used to help fund to guarantee a bank loan, I should say, those kinds of things. And that's on the basis of some investment in the film and some seeing that there's some pre-sales and things like that. So, you know, I'm not going to say it doesn't exist anymore. I think they're still happening at some level. You know, the banks are still in business, so that's something to say
right.
about that. I do think that in the micro-budget sphere, we might see opportunities for this not from the traditional film lenders, but maybe from just small business lenders looking at, okay, you're going to make a movie for $50,000, $60,000 and sell it on Netflix and iTunes and maybe from your own website. And if you can say that Netflix is on board and iTunes is ready to, you know, put the movie in the store, you might be able to take that to the bank and, with a business plan and so on. So it's, again, the micro scale version of a negative pickup deal. I haven't seen it yet, but I imagine it's coming.
Yeah, just going back to the pre-sales of it, that's a fascinating point right there. And but going back to pre-sales for a second, now, so I'm a producer. I've got this movie, and I've got it in development. I mean, I haven't shot it yet. So can I get a sales agent to try and pre-sell it? And if so, you know, how do I mean, in other words, how do I ultimately end up getting the best deal for myself where I'm protected? Because we all hear about, you know, the distribution companies and nobody makes money. You know, producers don't make money. Everybody's always in the red. Nobody makes it into the black. You know, Avatar hasn't, you know, Titanic. You know, none of these movies have ever made any money in
right.
the history of the world.
Yeah.
And yet some people are driving very fancy cars, you know, off of these
sure.
movies. So how, and I know that a little guy in the Midwest or a little guy in L.A., you know, and I sell, if I'm lucky to walk into some distributor's office and I sign a thing and they go, yeah, we're going to sell Asia, how do I ever track that stuff? I mean, that they're making money
yeah.
or that I should be getting paid.
That is a real practical challenge. And my best answer to that is make sure you're doing business with reputable people. You know, so you know, anybody can call himself a distributor's rep or
mm-hmm.
a sales agent, and there's no training or qualification that's required in order to get that title. And so be really careful about who you're doing business with and that they have some experience and some connections. You know, the guy who used to work for another sales rep and you know, had a few relationships by virtue of that, but never has really run his own shop as a sales agent, probably isn't a great bet for your film
right.
if it's his sort of first time out on his own. And you know, so and the kinds of things that you watch for as red flags are, you know, as soon as you're making the deal with that rep, are they doing the deal in a business-like way? It's amazing how often a filmmaker comes to me and says, yeah, we've got this distributor's rep and we're waiting for his contract, and then the contract comes through and it's this cobbled together slice of junk, and you know, you can just tell this guy's never been down the road before, and you know, went scrounging around for, you know, an old copy of an old deal somewhere and you know, just hasn't figured out what their deal really looks like, and the deals can be, you know, varied. So there you go. That sort of it. So watch for how they do the deal with you, because that's how they're going to do the deals with the distributors and the exhibitors. And as far as the financial end of things, make sure you have, you know, good audit and accounting provisions in the contracts, and that's again where the lawyer can really come in handy, and making sure that they make sense, making sure that you have the right to go in and look at their books and determine whether they're paying you properly. You still need to know that it's, you know, that there's a problem, so you know when to look, when to go investigate. But at least you have the right to investigate, and it's surprising how often that's left out of the basic deal until someone goes and writes
it. Got it, right. Well, yeah. it amazes me because there's just so many moving parts to making a movie, from the very beginning to the very end, and the life that it has afterwards. And all of those moving parts have expertise requirements, you know, and knowledge requirements that some people, you know, might have most of it. But I could bet that the smartest and most successful filmmaker today relies on a team of people to put their films together. They don't rely on themselves. And I encounter, especially in the micro-budget and low-budget world, so many filmmakers who do try and wear all hats. And, you know, and hence, you know, the admonition, I guess I want to say, of if nothing else, getting the seed money to hire the right people and the attorneys to make your world so much easier, you know, when you make and release your movie. You know, you just can't say it enough, and to make sure that your butt is covered, you know, and that you're going to see what you want to see when it's all over. And then it's kind of a roll of the dice anyway, but you set yourself up for, what you do is you put the odds on your side as opposed to the odds against you from the start.
Yeah. You know, I want to just say something. You mentioned hiring your team, and, you know, certainly your professionals, your lawyer, your accountant, you know, some of the line producers, folks like that, are you going to need to hire them, and you're going to need some money to do that. But, you know, building your team can also mean, like I said, finding those producers who fill in the areas where you have maybe not, I'm not going to use the term weakness, but some lower level strengths. And, you know, the good news is there's a lot of folks out there who are in this business, have some experience, want to be doing this kind of stuff, and are willing to come on board to projects on, you know, on spec, essentially, for a piece of the producer's fees when the film is made. And that's where they get the fancy cars, by the way. You know, they get paid a producer fee while the film is in production. So, so the point is, you can bring those people on as sort of partners and assemble your team without having to lay out cash initially. The risk, the downside, is that when you do that, you are bringing on partners, and they then have a say in how the business runs. And it's not unusual to see the partners essentially swallowing up the project and the original torchbearer for the piece sort of standing on the sidelines wondering what happened. And so, again, making smart deals, having good advice and representation when you're bringing on your partners is critical. As often as not, two people meet over lunch and decide to do something together, and then 6 months later, one of them screws the other one over somehow, and they never got a deal on paper. And so there's no way to tell.
Again, incredibly sage and critical advice. I've been burned scores of times because I've trusted people, as we all have. But I just yesterday afternoon, got very sad news from an acquaintance friend of mine who formed a company with two other people and got pushed out because their two halves made more than his share, kind of thing. And he got pushed out. They've taken over the company. And he founded it, started it, did 99.9% of all the work and brought them into it. And now he's out of it.
And that may be, you know, I mean, if they did their paperwork right, he may have been bought out, or he may have had, you know, some kind of a, something in exchange for his lost expectations.
Apparently he had them, sadly, yes, if he had, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. You know, and so that's another important thing is when you're making these deals to think about that. You are doing a sort of a prenuptial agreement when you get into partnerships. You want to make sure you have a not just a discussion of the upside, but what happens if things aren't working out. If you do want to get squeezed, if you're going to get squeezed out from an artistic point of view, that can be very painful. But, you know, at least being made whole financially makes it an easier pill to swallow. So,
right.
And that's what lawyers can do. You know, we can't take away the hurt. We can take away the loss, the tangible or measurable loss. And that's what we're here for.
Well, you know, we are at that point where we've got about, you know, 5 minutes left before the show is over. You know, I'd love to have you back at another time to continue this discussion. I mean, there's so many things that we still could talk about. If you're willing to do that, we'll set that up for another time. And this has just been fabulous information. I guess in the remaining couple of minutes, are there any tips or any suggestions you can recommend? I guess without giving away the farm, but recommend for where people might look to find these kind of investors, or any suggestions as to who might in this economy now be investing in this sort of thing? People are always going, where do I go to find money? And, you know, that's a tough answer, and often a secret that most people don't want to give away. So,
well, a couple things come to mind. You know, historically it was, you know, you go to the dentist.
Right.
You go to your dentist's looking for money because they tend to have a lot of money and I guess the glib answer is and maybe invest it a little bit more casually than many. I'm not sure that's really accurate or true these days, but, you know, you start with, obviously, you know, your contacts in with people who are in high-earning capacity jobs and things like that. And, you know, ask around. You ask everybody you know, hey, do you know someone who fits this qualification? Or better yet, who do you know who meets these criteria? And you ask them just to make that introduction. And, you know, you just go and you have a conversation with them. And I wouldn't try to sell them anything yet. I mean, you know, you might introduce yourself and explain what you do and that you're, you know, looking for people who might be able to help you move this project along, and that may be financing or maybe an introduction to somebody else. And it's the game of, you know, they told two friends and so on and so on. You expand your network sort of geometrically. You know, you ask everybody you meet to introduce you to two more people, and pretty soon you've got thousands of people that you've met, and you build a database.
True.
And, you know, just like being a salesman, you're going to look for, you know, your warm leads and your hot prospects and that kind of thing, and see if you can identify. Now, the trick is you're looking for the accredited investors because they're the ones, there's no limit on how many of them you can go to. And once you get into the circle with a couple of those people, their circles, you know, and you just keep expanding into their circles and so on and so forth, pretty soon you're going to be moving with some fairly high roller level folks. If you're disciplined about it and you go into it in a way of not being too aggressive about asking for money, first build relationships, then you know, get them to you know, contribute. Again, they're buying into you, so they have to know you and like you and trust you before they're going to do that. And, you know, let them get to know you. Building nowadays, the electronic mailing lists are a really useful tool to communicate about what you're doing and what's up and interesting information. And, you know, I submit maybe you could even benefit from just sort of curating information to your list of people, not just about your project. Don't always be selling, you know, just sharing, hey, you know, why it's, you know, you can do articles about why it's smart to invest in films or why it's not smart to invest in films or you know, profiles of people who've invested in films and seen, you know, positive results. And if you did a newsletter like that, I know some of the other guests that you have coming on in the next few weeks do just that. They have newsletters that they put out to not just to filmmakers, but to folks who are likely to maybe invest in things. And they pass it on. You know, so it's building a network. That's bottom line what it comes down to.
Excellent advice. Excellent. And you have been an excellent guest both times. I appreciate your work. I appreciate the offerings that you make available to your listeners of your podcast. And can you tell us a little bit about the podcast before we go away today? And then and it's at firemark.com is your website and your Twitter address and things like that.
Yeah, sure. So as you said, the website is firemark.com, and on my on the page that I set up, firemark.com/rex, is where you can find sort of the various of my offerings. I do have this email course that is basically the 6 ways of financing a film that we've just talked about. It's available, you know, in a series of lessons delivered by email for free. Just sign up and you get it, and it gets you on my mailing list so I can send you newsletters and things like that as well. There's also, I don't remember everything that's on that page. But yeah, there's my podcast. The podcast is called Entertainment Law Update, and that is myself and my co-host, a lawyer from the Dallas, Texas area, get together about once a month and round up the legal news stories of the month with some commentary and analysis, and we try to bring guests on the show and have an interesting discussion. Usually it goes about an hour. And it also is free. You can subscribe in iTunes or on my webpage. You can get notified when new episodes are out. That's entertainmentlawupdate.com as well. I have a book for podcasters, bloggers, and new media producers, and that includes, you know, web video producers and folks like that. It's called the Podcast Blog and New Media Producers Legal Survival Guide, and that is available through my website as well. And it's an ebook. And I'm sure I've got some other things up there as well. So you can find me, as I said, firemark.com. My handle on Twitter and Facebook and LinkedIn and most of the other social media sites is gfiremark. That's G-F-I-R-E-M-A-R-K. And you can find me. My office is in Westwood here in Los Angeles. My phone number is 310-243-6251. So feel free to give me a buzz if you have questions.
That is fantastic, and you have been fantastic, and I appreciate so much these past two interviews. I look forward to the next one, and we'll let listeners know when that is. But you have been stellar and very detailed in your approach to presenting information that I think so many of us, you know, especially, you know, when you argue the creative side, people have trouble wrapping their brain around. And sure. and I really appreciate that. You've done us a great service and offered so much value to the listener and to myself. I appreciate it, Gordon.
Thank you.
You bet. Have a fabulous day. I'm going to close out the show. You have a fabulous day. I'll talk to you in a few minutes. And thank you again so much. Enjoy the weekend.
Thanks.
All right. Again, my fascinating guest is Mr. Gordon Firemark. I want to say you're listening to Rex Sykes Movie Beat, and the official web address is rexsykes.com. Please don't go away without leaving comments and or rating and reviewing the podcast, because your comments help us out and help us extend our reach and promote my guests around the world to others who may not listen. I haven't said this recently, and I'm remiss for doing so, but I really appreciate your comments and support about the blogs and the articles and the conversations. And feel free to email me through the website anytime with feedback, with comments, with guest suggestions, and I'll see what I can do. And try to get back to you in a timely fashion. If you have questions for upcoming guests, you can also email those to me through the web address, through the website. All right. Now, you can become a member of Rex Sykes Movie Beat Facebook Friends by clicking the like page. There's no membership. You just click and like it, and we get to hang out. And there's information about upcoming interviews and films and different things that are there at the Facebook Friends page. Follow me on Twitter, Rex Sykes Movie BT. It's Rex Sykes Movie BT. The last word is abbreviated. I'm also on YouTube at Rex Sykes Movie Beat. And the movie that I'm directing, it's actually a short film, going to be a web series apparently, is called Serum, the Movie. And you can follow that on Twitter at Serum the Movie, S-E-R-U-M, Serum, like a truth serum, Serum the Movie. And we're also Serum the Movie on Facebook Friends. So I want to thank, again, Gordon Firemark for being here today, and for you, the listeners, the readers of Movie Beat. Got many more exciting guests coming up, so stay tuned. My first guest will be Monday, Sam Christensen. We have a full week of guests, so stay tuned. Please keep sharing the website and these interviews with all your friends and contacts. And everybody have a fabulous day, a fabulous weekend. Make your movies, complete your projects, and until we meet the next time, that's a wrap. Thanks, guys.